This is Across the Pond,
a podcast about the most interesting books and literary culture on both sides of the Atlantic.
I'm Laurie Feathers.
And I'm Sam Jordison.
Hi, Sam. We've got some sad news to talk about today.
We do. I mean, by the time our podcast goes out, a lot of people have heard this, of course, but we wanted to talk about it because he is such a towering figure and so great as well. And it's the fact that Paul Auster has died.
Yeah. And what an amazing literary career. 50 years of writing books, which include 18 novels, plus a slew of essays and poems and nonfiction books as well. I know that his penultimate book that was published, I don't know whether it was published in the UK or not, but it was about gun violence in the United States, a nonfiction book. Yeah, just what a great man of letters and so well respected.
Yeah, and fun to read as well. I mean, I absolutely loved, when I was in my early 20s, books like Moon Palace and, of course, the New York trilogy, which had a huge effect on me. And he wrote so brilliantly and elegantly about being young, among other things. And I know he's gone on to grow up and write about being old with, you know, equal brilliance. I have to admit that I stopped reading him, but not really for a good reason. There was a period of time when he was putting out a lot of books about stationery, essentially. I mean, he's renowned for his love of a nice notebook. And I kind of started to feel like that was taking over. I think unfairly, though. You know, he was one of those, in the way you sometimes grow out of youthful passions, I think I set him aside when I shouldn't have done, really, because his recent novels in particular, people say, are really fantastic.
Yeah, I've had, I guess, kind of the opposite experience with him and very limited experience. Our book club at Interrobang recently read and discussed Baumgartner, which is his last novel, published just last year, a really pretty slim novel, actually, which I know that he's written some real doorstoppers as well. But this one is about a man of 71, a widower, who's kind of like reflecting back on his life. It was beautiful. We had a really great discussion about it. Auster said at the time that it was published that he thought it might be his last book. I think he knew at the time that he had cancer and maybe didn't have, you know, a lot longer to live, which made the book all the more kind of poignant because it's a man that's looking back over his life.
Yeah, well, of course, on our last podcast, we spoke about Knife by Salman Rushdie. And in that book, he talks really movingly about Paul Auster's illness and also Martin Amis and Christopher Hitchens before him, these great writers who came to prominence essentially in the 1980s, who were real literary titans. I mean, I feel like they are now, looking back at them. I suppose to an extent we took them for granted at the time, but that whole generation, it really feels like it's coming to a close, that chapter in literary history. And it's very sad because they did wonderful things.
Yeah, I guess. And that's so nice that you know, it's transatlantic, you know, those guys in the UK, the guys in the US. And I'm trying to think of that great generation of now people in their 70s. Ian McEwan is still going and hopefully still writing. I'm trying to think of other authors that were in that kind of, you know, that great generation that we think about. I guess, I don't know, was Philip Roth friendly with those guys? I'm not sure.
Well, I know Saul Bellow was, but he came before them and was the elder statesman they looked up to.
Yeah, I know Martin Amis just almost deified Saul Bellow.
Yeah, really? Yeah. And I think that the thing that's come into my head, we're talking about men here primarily, but there were fantastic female writers who came up at the same time, but Angela Carter, for instance, but, you know, we lost her very much too young.
Yeah, well, and let's hope, you mentioned Salman Rushdie and Knife. Let's hope Salman Rushdie will stick around for quite a bit longer, you know, a few more decades at least, and give us some more of his wonderful books too.
Yes, please.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I've always wanted to read Paul Auster's 4321, which I think came out, I don't know, around 2018, if I'm not mistaken. Another big book, and I've heard people just rave about it, people that whose opinions I respect, and we kind of have similar literary tastes. So I need to get that one moved up on my list and try to read that. And I've not, though, read any of his earlier work. The New York trilogy, I hear great things about as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm not going to say much more than that, though, because to try and describe the New York trilogy is almost impossible. And it's certainly impossible to do without making it sound ridiculous, because it's full of these what seem like absurd tricks. There's lots of characters called Paul Auster in the first book of the trilogy, for instance. And I remember Kingsley Amis, the father of Martin Amis, himself a great novelist, his absolute fury when Martin Amis appeared in one of Martin Amis's novels. He, you know, apparently threw the book across the room and vowed never to read Martin Amis again.
His own son.
Yeah. But Paul Auster, I mean, it's a mark of his talent, and that he gets away with this in the New York trilogy brilliantly. It's just really good fun.
Yeah. One of the things that I guess he was kind of known for, some of these, you know, flashier or unusual kind of stylistic things that he did with his books. But Baumgartner is that any of those things are very absent. It's just a very quiet, contemplative book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think one of the things that in the UK we say about writers like Paul Auster, you know, they're very popular in France, as if that is a kind of term of disparagement. But, you know, who wouldn't want to be popular in France?
That's great. I love it. I think I'm going to use that this weekend, like when I'm out for drinks or something. Oh, that must be popular in France. Or if someone's dressed kind of unusually, it must be popular in France.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I just take that to read that, oh, they must be cool. But
yeah, exactly.
Not everyone does.
Exactly. Well, yeah, go out and read some Paul Auster, whether it's the, you know, the last novel, which, you know, you can literally read in 3 hours, or you want to take on one of the bigger ones and be a bit more ambitious. But I think that it's hard for me to think that there wouldn't be something out there that almost any reader would love and admire about his writing.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I've got a little thing that I want to announce that we're kicking off later this month. Actually, the first post on Substack will be May 22nd. And I've had lots of people ask, is this Substack going to be, you know, paid? Because I know that we all get those Substack announcements and subscribe to some. And then it's so frustrating because all you can do is like read like the first, you know, paragraph and a half. And then it's like, paid to subscribe or paid to read the whole thing. But no, this is going to be free. Myself and the writer Anthony Garrett are going to be posting approximately weekly about a monumental novel that's just been reissued by Dalkey Archive Press. And it's called Miss McIntosh, My Darling. The author is Marguerite Young. This novel was published in 1965. And it's been long, long out of print. And a bunch of us here in the States have been slowly, slowly, slowly waiting and watching for Dalkey to finally get this book out into the world to readers. And it's been out now about a month. It was quite a challenge to publish because it is a very, very large book. And
how long?
1,320 pages in the Dalkey Archive edition. And I actually have a earlier edition that I bought used online that was two volumes. And I know that the Dalkey people really wanted to do it as one book rather than two volumes. And so they had to negotiate with printers a lot.
Yeah.
Well, you know the difficulties in printing a big book, right? Like with Ducks Newburyport.
Yeah, it's a challenge. Yeah. How's the paper that they've got it on? Is it good quality?
Yeah, it's very nice paper. I mean, it's a larger format paperback. The margins are tiny. So it could have easily been, I think, 1,600 pages if it would have, you know, been more of a normal sized paperback. I think this project is going to take us, you know, a year, maybe more. We're not going to hurry through the book because there's nothing rushed about the book.
And what is this book? I mean, I guess you haven't read it yet, but...
Oh, I have. Well, I have not completed it. I'm like on page 760, I think.
You're halfway through.
Yeah, something like that. I guess if I was reading it on Kindle, I would be, I don't know, at 58% maybe. But it's a book about a young woman who travels from coastal Massachusetts to Indiana by bus. She's looking for her nursemaid who disappeared when she was 14. And this nursemaid, Miss McIntosh, was really the only stable presence in her life. She lived in this rambling, very kind of gothic home with a mother who was a former heiress, but the family money is all gone. And so the big house is chock-a-block full of all of this old stuff, very elaborate. But the mother is addicted to opium, and so she never gets out of bed, essentially. The father's long gone, never really been a presence. And it's hard to talk about what the book is about because the great thing regarding this book is not so much what it's about as the writing. The writing is absolutely lush and lyrical. And I know, Sam, that we've talked about this obsession that I have with abundance in literary fiction, and not just abundance in terms of page numbers, but just the aesthetic quality of abundant narrative and abundant prose. And this has that in spades. I mean, it is such a thick, juicy thing to sink your teeth into. I really recommend it to everyone.
It sounds amazing. And so how do people find your Substack?
The Substack is called Involutions of the Seashell, which is a quote from the book. And I think you can just, if you just Google it, I think that the Substack should come up. It's going to be authored by myself and Anthony Garrett. So I hope everyone will look into it. And I think that Dalkey Archive is also including it in their newsletter and maybe online as well.
Great.
So, Sam, that's it for me. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Laurie. Thanks.
Hello, Across the Pond listeners. Today we welcome to the show writer Ada Zhang, and she is here to talk to us about her debut story collection, The Sorrows of Others. Welcome, Ada.
Hi, Laurie. Thanks for having me.
Ada, would you like to read a short passage from one of the stories for us?
Yeah, sure. So I'm just going to read from The Subject, which is the first story in the collection. The summer before my junior year, I moved out of the dorms in Baxter Hall on the corner of Broadway and East 10th and took a room in a small house on Cherry Avenue, Flushing, Queens. I told my friends it was to save money, and they didn't ask why I didn't move to Brooklyn or Long Island City. Anywhere would have been closer. I suppose it was a point of pride among my college friends to live frugally, even if it was selective, even if it was abstract, since it was our parents' money we were spending every time we went out, our parents who paid our rents. But we were all very young back then, and I regarded hardship the same way I regarded my own shadow. I was aware of it, but rarely thought of it. Either way, it did not frighten me. The house was a low, squat rectangle with a patchy yard and a maroon awning over the front door. The windows were barred. A chain-link fence wrapped around the house, separating it from the sidewalk and from the homes on either side, which looked more or less the same as ours, the two-bedroom I shared with Granny Tan. Red brick with asphalt shingles scaling the roof, all faded and curling around the edges. At parties that summer, my living situation lent me an air of authenticity. I'd recently bleached my hair and dyed it blue to make up for the fact that I did not grow up in a progressive household. My parents are Chinese immigrants. We were middle class. Their politics were what you might expect. They believed in taxing the rich, but not in affirmative action. At the time, this brought me a deep sense of shame. I live in Flushing, I would tell a room full of hipsters, most of them art students like me. They all stepped closer. My roommate is this old Chinese lady. How old? Someone would ask. In her 70s, I think. Why does she need a roommate? To save money, I guess, I would say, and shrug, same reason as anybody else. The hipsters would nod and drink their beers, smug in the idea that there was a real one among us. There was a palpable fear in every young liberal back then that one could never be poor enough or of color enough to outweigh whatever privileges one had. Even those on scholarship felt insecure. We talked our heads off about gentrification, but said nothing when friends moved to Bushwick or Ridgewood, the then up-and-coming neighborhoods. It was amid such confusion and self-loathing that I began searching for a new place to live. I loved Flushing because I chose to be there, but at the time I believed I loved it for different reasons. The food, Chinese restaurants all up and down Main Street, noodles and dumplings next to Thai restaurants, Korean, Vietnamese, and the people who looked like they could be my relatives, the aunts and uncles and cousins I saw once every 3 or 4 years. We lived close to the botanical garden where it was quiet. I figured that was why the streets had such names as Maple, Blossom, Dahlia, Elder. I wanted to be an artist, a painter. It requires a certain amount of idealism to make art, and that comes more easily to some than others. The more privilege you had, the more ideal you ought to be, and the more you should be expected to suffer. That was what I thought. Portraiture was a dying form and still is, but I decided that if I was going to make a name for myself, painting faces was the only way. It was political and also romantic, my desire to suffer. It served me well while I had few responsibilities. I'll stop there.
Brilliant. Lovely. So quite a few of these stories, like this one, are about people who are starting out in life, essentially. They're on the cusp of adulthood. And you write very evocatively about how it feels to be in that situation and their kind of hopes and expectations and perhaps gradual disappointments. But another really interesting thing that happens is that there are these characters like Granny Tang and older characters. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about them and why they're so important in these stories.
Yeah. Well, I think just in how you characterize my younger characters as a little bit on the cusp of something and they're dreaming and they have hopes and ambitions. I think my older characters, you know, like those stories are also coming of age stories, I think. And they're also coming of age in their own way. And they're at a point in life where they've come of age before. You know, this is not the first time they've found themselves on the precipice of maybe like a new time in their life. And so, you know, how do you walk forward in life when you've had hopes dashed and sort of maybe dreams even came true, but the reality of one's ambitions are not the same often as your dream of them. So, and then with, you know, between my characters, young and old, you know, I want to create this like looking glass where they can kind of peer at one another from these different vantage points. But yes, I would say for my older characters that they still have hopes and expectations of life and demands of life and needs unmet. And but you know, they approach moving forward a little differently than the younger characters do.
Right. And do they also help the younger characters look back in a way? I think they quite often form a bridge back to China, essentially, because the older ones are the people who tend to have stronger connections there. And there are interesting things that happen as well in relation to, some of them are connected to the Cultural Revolution, for instance. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that and the importance of how that plays out in the book.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want like the Cultural Revolution to like take over the book or take over these characters' lives, because, well, because I think any of us, like, we've all lived through kind of collective events in the States. One of them that just immediately comes to mind is like a collective trauma. We all went through like 9/11, you know, we all kind of have these memories of our collective history, but then our personal history still exists. It coexists with the world that we live in. So our inner life doesn't stop just because externally some great tragedy has occurred. You know, you still, even in desperate times, in war times, in revolutionary times, people still have their dreams, and they still have, you know, they're still falling in love. They're still grappling with death on a very personal level. So I think I wanted to bring the Cultural Revolution, you know, out of just the public discourse and bring it into these characters' lives in a way that it wasn't like, you know, this big event that affected, if you were living in China during the 60s and 70s, this affected your life. It affected everybody's life. But I wanted to decenter that. You know, it affected everybody's life, but it's not like everybody's life became like totally just like a right angle offshoot of that event. And affected people's lives very differently. Some people were affected, like in the story Knowing, that has a very, very direct effect on these two families' lives, actually. But then, you know, in other stories, it's kind of just almost like just like a data point, you know, it kind of moved all of the country, you know, after the Cultural Revolution and when Deng Xiaoping took over from Mao and opened the doors to China in 1978, I believe, you know, that's when China started being on the track that you see China, you know, very successfully being on now, where, you know, the country within such a short amount of time acquired a lot of wealth, a burgeoning middle class, but that all kind of, you know, that kind of, the country was completely different, you know, even just like 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And when I hear my relatives talk about it, it seems, I wonder what it would be like, because my older relatives will talk about how they've just seen their country change completely in their lifetime, and like multiple times. And I think that's kind of astounding. And so, of course, I kind of cannot write about Chinese people without in some way like thinking about that. But again, I didn't want it to like start like to pollute the entire collection or the lives of these people, because I don't think that's what happened.
Well, I think it's really fascinating that you talk about all of these fascinating women, whatever their age, that they're kind of all going through kind of a coming of age or turning a new leaf or a new period in their lives. But while they might have that similarity, I feel like there's a big tension within many of the stories because they just don't seem to be able to communicate or understand each other very well. So do you want to talk about, I don't know whether you would call it in your mind like a generational divide, or what is inhibiting these characters from really understanding each other? Or in some instances, it seems like they're absolutely talking over each other. They're in dialogue, but they're just not connecting.
Yes, they try to connect. And I think it's that effort that is interesting to me, where more often, whatever they say, and they're trying to reach the person across from them, right? Like old to young and vice versa. Often it's the young characters that are extremely provocative of the, you know, trying to get these older generations to overcome their reticence and to talk. But more often than not, I find in life and it's good material for fiction, but I find in life that, you know, whatever we say, even if we're saying it, we think we're saying it for the good of the other person, we're trying to connect with that other person, we're really often just talking about ourselves and revealing a lot about ourselves. And I don't think it's a, and I think that's like quite natural. That's that like barrier, between two people, that impassable gulf that language tries its best to mitigate, but language is all we have. Can't read each other's minds, unfortunately. So all we have is language, and it is quite useful, but often it's just not enough. And so I'm very moved by my characters, their effort to do this impossible thing to try and reach one another. It's quite difficult. And it's difficult, you know, it can be difficult between strangers, sure, but it's very difficult between two very close people, as it turns out, mother and daughter, grandmother and granddaughter. Yeah, as much as it is best friends. I think there's a story about best friends where the friendship starts falling apart and they try to have a conversation, but each one is kind of missing the other one. And those misunderstandings are as meaningful as the misunderstanding that, going back to the first story that I read from, that the narrator and Granny Tan have with one another. And with that story is interesting because the main character who narrates the story, she, you know, Granny Tan starts out as a stranger and she tries to kind of force this closeness on them. And a few people have asked me before, like, do you think they really connected? Like, do you think they actually made any kind of meaningful bond there? And it's for everyone. I can't say, you know, to someone else what it should be, but I think that they connected on some level. I think ultimately it was probably a little disappointing to the narrator, but also the narrator was very naive and young in thinking that, you know, you could just walk into an old person's life and they can share everything with you, just because you have some surface similarities and just because you're approaching with what you think is goodwill. So that's the thing about connecting also, is like nobody owes you their connection. People can always withhold, can always withdraw into privacy. And I find that really fascinating too.
Talking of those misunderstandings, there's a moment in the story, the one that's called The Sorrows of Others and gives the collection its name, where a new wife puts honey in the tea of her husband. And he, of course, prefers it bitter, which is a great moment in the story and made me think as a reader that, oh no, I mean, this relationship is doomed. They're never going to get on. But that's not actually what happens, is it? And it becomes a very different story. In fact, it feels like it's a story about the things this poor wife is getting wrong, or at least as far as the husband is concerned. But I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the journey you actually take us on and how you turn things around.
Yeah, I'm trying to like, the first draft of this story, actually, I don't think it had that uptick at the end, that like opening for possibility, that like, right, maybe, I mean, I'll just use my dad's reading of this story as an example, just because I think it's so funny. He's like, obviously, this is like it ends at the beginning. Like, this is the beginning of their love, like their marriage. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't necessarily think that, you know, that they like fall in love, like in the young people's sense of like falling in love. But I suppose he's not wrong. You know, that it is a beginning of something. It does end at what feels like a beginning, because it feels like this Song Hao, this man, holds everything so close to his chest. And even with this, you know, here comes another, you know, character who comes along and is like trying to provoke and is like rearranging his whole house and kind of keeps bringing up his long deceased wife. And, you know, and the beginning, I found it pretty annoying and also like kind of a violent thing to do. I have to say, when I was writing this story, I was thinking about The Piano Tuner's Wives, a story by William Trevor. In that story, the piano tuner has one wife, and then his wife passes, and then he gets married again, and he is a piano tuner, and so he's very good. He's very good with his ears, but his eyesight is very bad, and so his first wife always told him kind of what everything looked like around him. Here's where this is. This is what this room looks like. Would paint the world for him, and then when he marries again, his second wife describes the same settings, but very differently. And so in doing so, she kind of changes his whole world and also erases his prior world, right, that his previous wife created. So I was thinking about that story a lot. You can see how this is in many ways an homage to Trevor's masterful story, The Piano Tuner's Wives, that everyone should read. But yes, this hopeful turn was something I arrived at after multiple drafts. And it actually happened after I brought in this sequence in the middle where he wakes up from a nap and then he takes a phone call with his daughter. For some reason, that wasn't in the original drafts. So I arrived at that scene much later, but in writing that scene with his daughter and just bringing his daughter in into the story a little more, she's not one of the main characters, the way that Song-Hal and Yulan, his new wife, are. But it allowed me to access this lonesome man who, again, keeps everything so close that it even shut me out, like the writer. Like he became inaccessible to me, which was a real problem. But once I, you know, could hear him talking to his daughter, and this is like the kind of the one big stake in the world that he still has is his daughter. And, you know, she's becoming an adult. She's, you know, she could have her own story where she's kind of coming of age. And I think in parallel, he starts to also think of his life as, okay, like, you know, maybe there is just a way forward that will also allow my grief, which is, you know, an expression of love for his first wife, to exist. Maybe I can have both of those at the same time. So I think it was, you know, coming, me getting more access to this character allowed me to find this ending for him that would allow his life to get bigger. I get the sense that he's kept his life so small for a long time out of a desire for safety and peace and, but now at the end, I do feel like his life kind of opens up.
So for context, we should probably quickly explain that his daughter has pretty much arranged this new marriage he's entered into.
Oh, yes.
But the thing I want to ask now is if you remember how you thought the story would go originally.
I think the story originally, I do remember the original ending. It was, the beginning was the same, you know, the line, the apartment was eerily clean and he wondered if she had not been trying to restore the place so much as to make it foreign to him. I wrote that line first in the story and I was, you know, and then I knew I had to write this story. And in the first draft, yes, I do remember they're having this dinner. So it is, you know, in the same scene, they're having this dinner. She's bringing up the latest building collapse in China, but it kind of just ends there. Like she just says all this stuff and he just clinches even tighter. So actually it's like he doubles down on, so that was the original ending, was that he doubles down on his desire to not connect with this person. So, you know, he has this like very visceral reaction to her bringing up constantly from her readings of old newspapers, you know, the tragedies that have happened to this person, just the news. She's just bringing all the catastrophes of the world into their home. And, you know, this line, he wished to keep his heartbreak close, not let it enter the torrent of all the world's misfortunes, which were infinite, as Yulan proved over the weeks, no one more special than the rest. I think the story kind of ended there. So the, you know, this, in this, the iteration that's in the book, the story goes forward from there, and he actually sees, you know, that she's moved an old photograph of his dead wife into the living room, into the open space. And that was part of the later drafts. I did not discover that she had done something so bold, I guess, until later on, kind of around the time when I brought the daughter into the story more.
Right. So the light came into the story. It's really interesting.
Yes.
So Ada, the collection has 10 stories, and I wanted to talk with you a bit about the last story, The Compromise. But I see some parallels, and maybe others wouldn't see them, between the story that you read from, the first story, the subject, that bookends one, the beginning, and then the ending story, The Compromise, because it seems that, like Granny Tan, the character in The Compromise, Sue, an elderly Asian woman who's made great sacrifices for her family and is hardworking and just kind of goes about life with, I think, really just a beautiful, quiet grace about her. And I just, feeling that parallel, I wondered whether in your own life you have women in your life that are kind of like these characters in any way.
Sure. I don't think any of them are exactly like these characters. It's interesting that you say that you find them somewhat graceful in the way that they kind of move along, push it along, and get through life and tend to the things they need to tend to. And that is one reading, and I think that is what many people looking at them would say about them. There's almost something noble about how they have chosen to live, these sort of like quiet lives where they keep to themselves. And yes, I guess I have seen these women in my life, not just Asian women or Chinese women, all kinds of women. Women are like this. Like, this is what we're good at, you know. Women can endure until the end of time, which is, you know, which is something very, very amazing about women that I have observed. But I think as I got older, I started to realize there are like sometimes very wild longings underneath that seemingly placid surface. And it's just that, you know, so many women in my life have, you know, in order to move forward gracefully, they sort of close the door on certain events in their past, and they learn the power of silence. You know, silence appears very graceful. Silence is so powerful. You know, what you don't say is almost, you know, more interesting and more damning than whatever it is you do say. Because like I said earlier, what we say often, we're showing ourselves whenever we speak, even if we think we're talking about something external. It's always kind of about us. But if you don't say anything, you kind of remain a mystery. And if you get really good at not saying anything, you can even become a mystery to yourself. You can even forget that thing that you refuse to say or that you can't say. So I've just became like really interested in that placid surface, but also in like in what's below, because I, you know, as I've gotten older, these women in my life, that I put on a pedestal often, you know, even when I was just talking about women, you know, oh my gosh, they seem just these incredible creatures of endurance, but really they're just people. So they've had their share in disappointment and in misbehavior. I mean, Sway in Compromise, yes, she seems like a pretty devoted mother and a pretty no-nonsense person. She doesn't really seem to cause trouble anywhere in her work, in her kids' lives. She's completely not meddlesome. However, like what you learn about her, you know, is that she used to be a very passionate person, and she's learned to curb that that side of herself, and not even curb, like just cut it off. So that's very fascinating to me. What do you know? What when you achieve grace, I feel like you give up other things. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of those other things, because there is that light and grace in the stories, but there's also a pretty delicious nastiness to some of the things your characters do. I'm thinking particularly of the story Julia.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you tell us a bit about that and what happens. And what I'm imagining is it must have been pretty good fun to write some of the mean stuff that happens in that story.
Yeah. Some people have called that story like a mean girl story. And people will often ask me like, how much of the book? And it's natural because, you know, I think we're in a time right now where a lot of, you know, nobody's put a name to it. But I do think this is, I mean, there's been what we're seeing now with so many Asian writers publishing is really unprecedented. Like there hasn't been this much. So I think it's very natural for people to ask like, how much of this was based on your real life? How much of this? And it's a fine question. And my hot take on writing fiction is that it's all autofiction just because it's all coming from you. So even if you're writing about aliens in Milwaukee, can you tell I'm in the Midwest right now? Then, you know, you're still writing about some obsession that you have, some question that is unanswered for you, which made you set out to write this story about aliens in Milwaukee, right? So, however, with Julia, like that one, I will say is the closest to something that happened in my life. And usually when I write, you know, the stories I write about, I get a line, maybe I get like a first sentence or an image, and then I don't approach it for a very, very long time. And I just let it kind of sit there. And with Julia, something had just, you know, happened to me with a friend. I, you know, we had a falling out and I immediately went to the page. And the first draft though was nothing like that what you read here. And what happened between me and my friend is nothing like what happens here. The material eventually got transformed. Like that's what happens after that's when you write fiction, it all gets transformed. I am a person, you know, I'm always encouraging my students to draw from their material, draw from what you know. But then I always also encourage them to break off into the unknown, you know, write into what you don't know and let your imagination, which is so powerful and intuitive, turn that raw material into a real story. Because if you just, you know, write what you know, it's never really going to take off, you know, lift off the ground. It needs to be transformed. So yes, it was great fun writing Julia. It was also like some individual, like just my processing. I've never written a story like Julia before or after, you know, something just so close to me and something that had just happened. And for that reason, I think Julia took so many drafts. I think because the material was so close to me, it was harder to transform it than some of the other stories. So that one, gosh, like from when I first wrote it to, you know, the iteration in the book, I was revising that story up until like press date, you know.
So Ada, we're recording this with you on May 7th. And it occurs to me that we're almost exactly at the 1 year anniversary of the publication of The Sorrows of Others. It was your debut novel, or your debut story collection, rather, your debut book. And I kind of just want to know, how has life changed for you since this publication? And I know that you did a book tour. You came to my store in Terabang Books and did discussion. What's it been like, and what has kind of been predictable, like in terms of, oh, you know, this is the way I kind of thought it would go down, and what has been a total surprise?
Thank you for asking that, actually, because I feel like it would be helpful for me to think about this year and to think about what happened. And I, you know, honestly, what has been the most meaningful to me has been the people that I've met, like going to Interrobang in Dallas and meeting you. And now a year later, we're getting to do this podcast. And I was, you know, nominated for a prize that I know that you are sort of at the helm for. And I think like that's exactly, you know, meeting booksellers, meeting readers. That's exactly what I didn't anticipate that I would enjoy it, because it is like publicity. It's being around people. It's quite noisy. But actually, I have found that, you know, booksellers, first of all, I think are like angels on earth, and I think that the work that they do is really tough and extremely important. And so meeting booksellers, I feel like I'm meeting superstars. Like I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, thank you for having me at your store. And I've seen how making connections with people in that way, meeting booksellers, meeting readers, that's still the strongest pulse that I have found that there is for literature and for books having a life of their own. And how do they get to have a life separate of you? You know, I can't go touring for my entire life forever, but it's because of people like you and other booksellers who continue to keep my book alive and to pass it on to other people. And I, you know, those people pass it on to other people. So, you know, I think when I was gearing for publication, I was feeling all the feelings, but I was feeling very much like, gosh, I don't really have an online presence. Like, so is that, and I know like social media is so much a part of our lives at this point. And so I wondered if my book would suffer because of that, but there was also nothing I could do because I'm not someone who enjoys being on social media. And so in some ways I felt like I felt like I was putting my child at a disadvantage because I couldn't be like an influencer, you know, I couldn't like be on Book Talk and TikTok or whatever. But I have found that there's a way to do it in your own way. And it's really, really thanks to the people like going, that's why it was so important for me to go to Texas, because Texas is where I'm from. And I know there are people reading in Texas, despite the craziness that goes on in Texas. And because of the craziness that goes on in Texas, I felt even more compelled to go to Texas and to be there and to see the good work that people are doing in Texas to keep people reading and to keep literature thriving. And so I would say like, just meeting booksellers and being with people. And honestly, readers have been so generous and nice. You know, it's very terrifying to be so exposed, but I've received, you know, the good thing about being, I did create a social media account just for the book, and readers have written in like message, and they send the most like the sweetest messages, you know, that are like, one guy was like, I am a Chinese American living in Texas, and this book, like, you know, like meant a lot to me. And that's really amazing, because that's the reader I was looking for. You know, that's the person I wanted to reach. And I'm so glad that through my book, we've kind of found each other, that person and me. Yeah. So, you know, we talk about these impassable gulfs. I think books help to bridge those gulfs so that people can reach one another.
Yes, and overthrow a stereotype that Texans don't know how to read. So thank you for helping with that too. We do know how to read.
Texans can read. We can read.
Well, Ada, I love the short story collection, and I'm so happy that you were able to join us today. And I look forward to reading more of your writing in the future. I don't want to jinx you by asking you what you're working on or when your next book is coming. but I am hopeful we're going to see much more from you, because you certainly are talented. And I'd like to encourage all of our listeners out there, if you haven't yet, it's time. It's been out 1 year. Go to your local independent bookstore and pick up a copy of the story collection, The Sorrows of Others by Ada Zhang. Thank you for joining us, Ada.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Ada.
Thank you for listening to Across the Pond. If you like the show, please follow us on your favorite podcast app.
And tell your friends.